Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we are going to dive into the Constitution. We got just a couple more, maybe a page left of content or material that we need to cover. And we do have Paul because he's gonna finish this journey with us. And actually, Paul, when we're done with this, we'll try to pick it up first thing tomorrow. Right when we were going into the Constitution, we had just finished kind of going through Madison and the Virginia resolutions in response to the Kentucky resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were kind of halfway, if not maybe one-third of the way through, actually probably a quarter of the way through the content, because the resolutions just kind of draw the line and call everybody out. But it's the details that Madison provides later in his report and in his notes on nullification that really help clarify precisely what they were intending to do, what must be done when it comes to enforcing the Constitution. And so
we know, GR, that's really germane. It's really germane right now because the interest on nullification is growing. There are a couple of organizations that are really pushing the idea of nullification. And so for us to do this at this time is really timely.
Oh, right. Actually, so well, there's a push to do something. And
right.
Everybody is, you know, many people have dug in on the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, some people, and kind of in a way, it's almost like, you know, the medieval times of medicine, because there are these remedies that people believe in, like bloodletting, that they
right.
think, oh, this is what we need to do. And mm-hmm. Those who believe that the Constitutional Convention is the thing that needs to happen, well, that's like bloodletting. That has nothing to do with the cure at all.
Right.
It is a completely different process. It has nothing to do with enforcing the Constitution. In other words, the problem is the government is violating the Constitution. And
sure.
it literally is tantamount to applying the wrong type of medical procedure to a problem.
Correct.
And it's the same thing with the nullifiers, those who are calling for nullification as well. They're going down the wrong path. As a matter of fact, they may be closer to the problem, but they're far more, as I say, they're far more dangerous than bloodletting. I mean, bloodletting, you can put yourself into a, you know, state of shock or, you know, bad things if you're sick. But the nullifiers, all they do is they really create confusion. And that's even worse.
Dangerous, that's a pretty strong term.
What's that?
Dangerous. When you say dangerous, that's a pretty strong term. You know, when you say, you know, the nullifiers are
more dangerous,
that process is more dangerous. You know,
right.
In sincerity, these people really believe that they've got a solution. So I guess what we want to do is point out what they might be missing and give them the alternative that the founders intended. Does that make sense?
Yes. So the nullification process, I look at as more dangerous, but it isn't the most dangerous. The most dangerous is the sovereign citizen movement, because that gets people to become incapable of doing anything about the problem. See, the nice thing about nullifiers is they can actually, you know, go into details about the problem, and they'll apply a very bad principle regarding the problem and create chaos and make, you know, so in other words, they'll actually walk away going, okay, good on Idaho for nullifying this gun law that come out.
Okay.
And so, but they have no idea the damage and, you know, and the chaos that it will be creating. And more importantly, how they now stand. I mean, because Tom, we'll get into this. I don't want to get into the conversation now.
Sure.
So, because Thomas Jefferson for Kentucky, he used the terms nullification. And so it becomes synonymous. Nullification is what Thomas Jefferson called for.
Okay. Was it a bad choice of words when Jefferson used it?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And well, so it was placed out of context, because when you really look at trying to nullify the federal laws, as Madison emphasized several times, it is not done by a single state. It has to be done by all of the states or by a majority of the states. We'll get into that. We'll dive into that because it's really, really important. And then once we do that, once we cover nullification and the convention and these folks that are, you know, running around, you know, saying, get out now before it's too late. They're the worst. They completely take you out from being able to help and assist with the problem now.
Yeah. My experience is that people actually become, they extracted themselves from dealing with the issues directly. Right. And you know what? Let's go on because we could go off on a tangent there.
Okay, with that, we were talking about and we were just covering the Equal Rights Amendment. And
yeah, I think we had just finished the Equal Rights Amendment, right?
No, actually, we just started. We covered Section 1, but
okay.
So I want to apply a little background.
Okay.
This was proposed in 1972, and this came on the heels of civil rights, the Civil Rights Act, and now that, you know, all men would have equal rights, women stepped in and said, hey, we want to be a part of this movement too. And I started talking about how and I don't know if I was really clear, but I talked about how, you know, one gender over there's no such thing as equality of the genders. Men will never be able to bear babies, you know, and there's things that women will never be able to do. And
so this
all points to a really divine nature of the sexes. That there is, you know, this divine role that each of us are to play. And so, go ahead.
I'm just curious to know what rights, and I don't want to, for our audience, I don't want to sound like a chauvinist or ignorance, but I'm just curious to know what rights were being requested that women were being denied that this amendment was supposed to solve.
Oh, okay. So at the time, many women were not able to have certain types of jobs. As a matter of fact, women were not allowed to go into combat. Women were not allowed to have, I mean, there were corporations that basically said, you know, just like the word golf, the sport or the, you know, the game golf, you know what golf stood for, right? G-O-L-F.
No. No, I didn't know it was an acronym.
Oh, yeah. It's an acronym. Gentlemen only, ladies forbidden.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
I never knew that, GR.
It was a gentleman's sport.
I did not.
And men were really serious. So here's the thing. You know, let's say a group of guys come along and they create something. And let's say they create this and they go, this is for men. We're doing this and we want to do this for men. And we're going to create, you know, as a part of the rules of the game, men only.
Okay.
And, you know, it's kind of like our Father in heaven. deciding that, you know, women, only women can, you know, bear children, you know, and how the sexes have been divided in this divine scheme, in his plan. And so, you know, obviously there needs to be a symbiotic relationship between the genders, because if not, society would be dead. And so, but let me just work with this one thought that, you know, let's say the women come along and they say, hey, this is something just for women. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, nursing was really, really perceived as a women's position.
Sure.
And men started breaking into that paradigm. And in some respects, women felt that, hey, if you can break the paradigm of, you know, this is a woman's job and take jobs from us, then why can't we fulfill some of those jobs? And this became the elephant in the room, because there was no reason why a woman couldn't become president of the United States. I mean, when you read the documents, the framers' paradigm, they actually felt that the woman's role was not less than man. It was different.
Okay.
And so, and even women of the time, back in the 1700s, they felt the same way. They felt that there was many things that they could do, but that it was far better for a man to, you know, man to go out and hunt and man to go out and, you know, provide and so forth. And in a general aspect, there are, I mean, even today, with the Equal Rights Amendment in our face right now, we look at how we see the genders with this dystopia, this gender dystopia.
Dysphoria, right. Dysphoria,
thank you. Folks, I'm really struggling here. No, but you know what? Yeah. By the way, I got to do a go back.
Okay.
So Friday, I was unable to broadcast my show. And I really wanted to broadcast because it was the Marine Corps' birthday, and I read the Marine Corps message, and I ranted about being a veteran. And how I just, so I think it's fitting to air that, but I really wanted it to be on, you know, on the Marine Corps birthday,
because
it precedes Veterans Day. And I just wanted to express how I felt about how society asks veterans to stand up so we can applaud you because we want to recognize your sacrifice. And to me, that's just an insult. But, But anyway, so what I'll probably do is I'm going to probably go ahead and play that this Friday.
Okay.
Or I will probably play that. You know what? I think it'll be better to play it on the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And because on Thanksgiving and on the day before Thanksgiving, it'll be the same show because I'm going to, and let me set the stage, folks. I would ask that you air my show in your homes on Thanksgiving as I cover this nation's first Thanksgiving and what Thanksgiving really should be. I'm not here trying to kick everybody's, you know, football games and what do you want to call it, gorging or gluttony in the teeth, but the framers really created the proper paradigm as to what we really should be doing. And I think that it's a message that every Christian and every good citizen of this nation needs to understand. That we should be in service of him who gave us this Constitution, not, you know, serving ourselves by, you know, forcing, you know, and, oh, well, we kind of wrap it up with all of these nice, oh, well, it's about the family, getting families. I'm okay with getting families together. I'm okay with, you know, strengthening the bonds, you know, in a spiritual manner with your family. But why are we doing the one, what we would call the traditional Thanksgiving that has nothing to do with this nation And as a matter of fact, what it does is it recognizes the failed society of the pilgrims, because the pilgrims, when they had their first Thanksgiving, they were communal. They were socialists.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we try to recreate that socialist mentality?
Well, I think, GR, that the... The original message is missed. You know, that the Congress unanimously asked George Washington to declare the value of Thanksgiving. And I'll tell you what, I didn't know that. I didn't know that growing up, GR. That was unfamiliar to me.
Well, sure. And I think that if the schools today taught what this nation did for its very first Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. we would be far more understanding of what we should be doing instead of what we are doing. Because what happened in Massachusetts was very different than what happened in Virginia at that same point in time. Because the nation's very first Thanksgiving really occurred in Virginia.
Right.
Because it was the Virginians that bore the very first Thanksgiving of giving thanks for, you know, for the land. And they actually thanked God. It wasn't a feast. It was, you know, a day of humility and service.
Right.
Which is why the Virginians, and which is why Congress, because I think it just came out of, you know, those people more so than, because the Puritans were just a small faction. And that's why the very first nation's Thanksgiving was tailored after the very first Thanksgiving in Virginia.
Right. And well, that's a valuable piece of information that we're going to be sharing.
Yeah,
today,
Yeah. So anyway, so setting up the ERA in 1972, you know, oh boy, these women wanted equal rights. And as a matter of fact, they created federal laws that mandated that schools needed to make sure funding was equal for women's sports as it was for Title IX and all. And all of these things are unconstitutional. But okay. they started going down this path of saying, we need to do these things. And so the federal government started making concessions, and they mm-hmm. tried to create this paradigm. And as a matter of fact, this all boiled to a point of, I think it was 1975, when there was the Battle of the Sexes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Battle of the Sexes really was in a sport that both men and women had shared. And do you remember that match between Billie Jean King and Rigby, or Bobby Riggs, or whatever his name was?
Yes, I do remember that. Barely, but I do remember that was a big event.
So Billie Jean King was a very formidable, I don't know if she was the best tennis woman player in tennis, but she was a formidable player. And the man she was competing against was, I mean, at best, marginal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was nowhere to be found in, you know, the Wimbledon and the Opens and, you know, in these real ultimate challenges for real competition among the men. He just happened right. to be kind of a washout. And, you know, he, I believe, was on the take to try to make hay out of this so that, you know, it would be an opportunity for him to make money. Because
right.
that's what I believe his name's Bobby Riggs. And so
right.
So when we look at what ended up happening, there was all sorts of hyperbole, and yeah, it was Bobby Riggs. And so everybody goes, oh, this is going to be it. This is a true match between the sexes. And I go, well, hold on here. You know, my thinking was, well, why isn't it, you know, the highest acclaimed man against the highest acclaimed woman? You know, the actual best.
Right.
I mean, Riggs, you know, he didn't come across as a real manly competitor.
Okay.
He just had a big mouth.
Okay.
And he was actually, You know, it was almost like the Muhammad Ali PR team went over and kind of, you know, told him what he needed to do, because that's what he did. He kind of blew off his mouth and said, oh, yeah, you know, women, you know, no woman can beat a man. That kind of hyperbole. But anyway, so this was really sold, and Billie Jean King beat him. And I mean, she beat him. And so everybody goes, ah, it's settled. See, we're all equal.
Right.
And it actually didn't settle anything, really. All it did was it put a feather, or it gave some momentum to their movement, but it didn't really prove that we were really equal. We'll never be equal. As a matter of fact, folks, to this day, all you've got to do is bring up whenever you see a transgender in some competition, you know, some male in a female competition, just think about the damage that, you know, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs did to our system by trying to say, hey, these things are equal. You open the door for men to come, you know, to actually go down this terrible, destructive path.
Mm-hmm. Right. And see, I see. Now, this is inoperative. This expired unratified.
Yes, and that's okay, the most beautiful thing about this. That was one of the – I loved it because they thought that if they actually put an expiration to it, it would drive people to get in there and pass it quickly, and it didn't.
Okay.
And so because it says let me see here. This Congress shall have the power to enforce this proper let me see here. Unratified, equality rights denied. I don't see where they actually put in the expiration, but I know it expired in 1982, so it had to have been in other language, because some of the actual amendments, like the 18th Amendment, actually had the language that it would expire at a very specific date.
Section 4, GR, it's in there.
Oh, hold on here. Am I missing Section 4?
I'm not. It's right here in front of my face.
I'm
Section 4.
Okay.
This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission.
There you go. Okay, so something happened. I must have accidentally deleted that out of this.
Okay.
So I need to go back and put that in. But okay, so I thought the language was in there, but for some reason I don't have it. Anyway, okay, so the next one was another amendment that was brought forward that was going to open up a can of worms that we already talked about, and I believe it was an amendment, which one was it? Was it the 23rd or the 24th? Yes, it was the 23rd. So what this next inoperative amendment did was it was going to move Washington, D.C. into statehood.
Hang on just a minute. Now, that's the one. Now, I don't have that one. Hang on a minute. Let me see if it'll take 2 years. Oh, yeah. Wait. Election Vice
President. So this was proposed in 1978.
Okay.
And it expired unratified in 1985.
You know what, GR? So let me tell you what. That's the one I was looking at. So you and I have the same problem. This part of this Section 4 that I was reading was in this article, not the Equal Rights article.
Oh,
I know
okay.
it's there.
Okay.
Okay. So okay. okay, we're looking now.
So I was correct. It expired. That Equal Rights Amendment expired, but the language wasn't in the amendment itself, like they did with this one and they did with the 18th. So with that, we got 9 seconds, Paul. We'll have to go into break right now. So,
okay.
Folks, when we come back, we're going to dive into how the District of Columbia and how, I'll just say, the progressives were trying to set up this autonomy and create a state of the seat of government, which would have been completely unconstitutional because when we went through the ratification debates, we highlighted the fact that it was to be autonomous and not to have any representation. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back. And actually, there was one thing I wanted to point out about the ERA. Now, everybody looks at the Billie Jean King and the Bobby Riggs match, but there were actually three matches in the Battle of the Sexes. And the first match was against Bobby Riggs. And oh, by the way, Bobby Riggs was a number one contender amateur, but he never made ranking amongst the professional tennis players.
Okay.
Now, there was a number one ranking player who kind of stepped in, and his name was Jimmy Connors. And he actually beat Martina Navratilova, who was a ranked female tennis player. And Bobby Riggs actually beat Margaret Court. So there were these three matches. And there was only, out of the three, there was only one, which was Billie Jean King beating Bobby Riggs. So anyway, it was a Pyrrhus victory, to say the least, when we look at the outcome today. Because, sure. I mean, I can't believe, if everybody plays context to what the Battle of the Sexes did back then, all it did was it just basically muddied the waters so that, you know, men can now actually compete as women.
Right.
And I think everybody has recognized that that right there set the stage to, you know, become a very destructive paradigm.
Oops.
There you go.
Right.
You know, with the best intentions come some very tragic outcomes. So now this one amendment in creating the seat of government as a state, as I was saying, it was clearly defined that it would only be a piece of land for the operations of the national government, never to be a state. It had no ability to, or any say, or any sovereignty to become equal to a state. Their job was to serve the states. That was it. So, Section 1, if you want to go ahead and, you know, read that off. Let's see what this
is. Section 1. For purposes of representation in the Congress, election of the president and vice president, and Article 5 of this Constitution, the district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall be treated as though it were a state.
Any misunderstandings?
No,
they wanted to actually, you know, get a star for District of Columbia to actually be within that flag so that we would then have 51 stars in our flag. Section 2, go ahead.
The exercise of the rights and powers conferred under this article shall be by the people of the district constituting the seat of government and as shall be provided by the Congress.
Okay.
Now,
go ahead.
What is this rights and powers under this article shall be by the people? Okay. All right, Section 3.
Okay. Go ahead.
The 23rd article of amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed.
Right, because the 23rd article, what did it do? It just created electors to placate the people who decided to become leeches to the seat of government. In other words, people who moved there to actually become, because a congressperson that was there, they couldn't vote in the presidential election other than by absentee ballot because they were representing another state.
Right.
And so it's the same thing. The president was not a resident of the United District of Columbia. He came from and was a resident of another state. Even the Supreme Court justices, even though they were kind of permanent residents because it was a permanent position, the intent was not to, you know, placate and allow bureaucrats and those on the bench to, you know, become a part of a state in the union. That right. was the, you know, there's the consequence. If you're going to take this position, you're not going to be able to elect, you know, because you, if you're not a resident of another state, which is why I think most of the Supreme Court justices are, you know, residents of another state. That's where they claim mm-hmm. their primary residence.
Right.
So as we look at this, this is repealing that because now they have the full, as a state, they will have the full privileges of a state with their electors representation. They'll actually have a voting member in the House of Representatives and they will have two senators.
Right.
So, and therefore they would be and actually would, you know, be qualified. I mean, they become a state in this actual amendment. Now, this whole concept that's out there, they've been floating this. This has come back around in the past year or two.
Okay.
And I think this needs to be highly revisited. This really needs to be, you know, laid out. And so when we go through the ratification debates, we could easily make more hay, and I think if it really comes up to be more, because the whole point of exclusive legislation was to ensure that they had autonomy from the rest of the states.
Correct.
Not to be a state, because what happens if all of a sudden they started creating laws? Now, one of the intents behind this was to actually allow them the constitutional power to create laws and give them reciprocity. In other words, if they could start creating laws of banning guns, if they could start mm-hmm. creating laws to, you know, invoke homosexual marriage and those types of things.
Right.
Right. In other okay. words, if they become a state, then those laws that they could get away with would then be forced down the throats of every other state.
Mm-hmm.
Because of reciprocity.
Yes.
So,
yes,
the fourth section, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall be ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission. So when you kind of look at, and I want to say that there's got to be, and it's hard to look up old amendments that don't exist. I mean, you can't go to Avalon and say, hey, what was that amendment? Right. So you really have to look for the amendments that never made it so you can actually see the language. And the problem is because there were really no debates on it. Actually, because these actually went out as recommendations by Congress. In other words, 2/3 of Congress voted for this.
Right.
And the same thing with the ERA. 2/3 of folks, when we look at our representation in D.C. in the 70s, they were okay with actually, you know, starting to go down these ultra progressive paths.
Right.
That's an indictment right there that kind of speaks to how far lost or how far, you know, beyond the Constitution, our federal government had become. Now,
the last one, and this is actually an amendment, the last amendment that we've actually faced and ratified was an amendment from the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
And this was the second amendment of the 12.
Right.
Now,
you want me to read that?
Yeah, but technically, so here's the question. Because it was considered the second amendment of the Bill of Rights, should this not have actually taken precedence and been placed as the first amendment? Because the because out of the 12 amendments, the very first two did not get ratified. But in placement, this really was the second amendment of the 12. Should it actually go and jump into the position that it had based on the Bill of Rights?
Well, that would have shifted all the other amendments down.
Oh, yeah, it would have. And you know what? I don't care how confused people are. That should not be a reason why we don't move it. In other words, that would not be a reason why. And as far as I'm concerned, the reason why I think it should have been shifted so that people could place context to, you know, how we ratified really a good amendment, even though it's, you know, not stellar. It's not like the very first amendment. But had we bumped it into the first, this would have become our first amendment, and the second amendment would have become our third. And the first amendment becoming the second, of course. But the whole point is that, oh, everybody, oh, they'd have to reprint material. Hey, we got to defend our Third Amendment rights. Right? But okay. I think it would have helped force and wake up to the people. We actually have one other amendment.
Right.
There's one more amendment that we really, and it's the one we really need, because it's the one that guarantees our representation. And I know we already covered it, folks, but this goes back to how important that First Amendment is. And I think had this amendment been placed as the First Amendment, and then people go, well, why did that happen? Why did you shift? Why did you confuse us? Because this is where it was placed, and now that it's ratified, everything should shift down. And that this could happen one more time if we actually ratify this other one. And then I believe, because what form of government do we represent or resemble today?
Well, I'll tell you, we're acting like a democracy.
And so when one would look at that very first amendment in the Bill of Rights that would guarantee representation of 30,000 people, do you think in people that have a democracy leaning would say, hey, that's a good idea?
I'm not sure.
Giving the people better representation in a democracy? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay. They probably would.
Yes. And I believe that's one of the reasons why they didn't even want to entertain the proper placement of this amendment. And made it, so, and it suffered it to become the 28th Amendment instead of the first or second, I mean.
So this was, remember, and this was part of what was originally considered the Bill of Rights.
Yep, that's right. My whole point. Because we have to tell people that this is actually a Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so it kind of lends to that. So, okay, so let's go ahead and dive into the text to this.
Okay. Article 27. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened.
Okay. So when we look at this whole amendment, I don't know the young man's name, but if you research this one amendment, the success story of this amendment becoming ratified really was driven by a very motivated college kid that wanted to prove to his professor
that an amendment could be passed. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 90s. They said, oh, because, you know, we looked at how many failures of amendments in the past, you know, couple decades. We know of two. And obviously, if anybody understands, by the 90s, education had gone so far over the deep end to be progressive. You know, these professors, they were the petri dish of the communist, you know, Bolshevik revolution. They were out of the closet so bad. I mean, that's how bad it really is today, that they're, you know, they're out there doing these things. So anyway, as we go ahead,
let me tell you what I found. The proposed amendment, this is about, was largely forgotten until Gregory Watson, an undergraduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, wrote a paper on the subject in 1982 for a political science course. Okay? He got a C on this paper, and he appealed it. They wouldn't change it, and so he fought it. And lo and behold, you know, so his question was, could this amendment be ratified? And so he drove this. Okay?
Uh-huh.
I just thought I would share that because I was looking it up. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought that would be interesting that a university student looked at this and said, you know, I wonder if we could do this. And he did it.
A 19-year-old. I just saw it too. So his name's Gregory Watson, and he was 19 years old. He was a teenager, folks.
Right.
A teenager who actually took it upon himself to get this amendment ratified.
Mm-hmm.
And he proved, because it was just a supposition that this amendment could be ratified, and he proved that it could.
Right.
The question is, did he get that A?
I think he got the A with the ratification.
Yeah, but there's no way that the professor went and actually changed that grade on that one that would have affected his overall grade. You know what I mean?
As a matter of fact, I'll tell you what. I think what drove him was the fact that he got a C. Okay. I think he believed, I'm going to prove this.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it work.
And he was absolutely right. Correct. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah. How many people out there really you want to see a significant change? Because, you know, how many people out there really want to drain the swamp?
Right.
The best way, because we actually have, folks, we have two amendments that could, you know, one could be ratified and another one could be rescinded, and it would destroy the swamp. I mean, completely destroy the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
Does America really care about the swamp, or do they believe that the orange man will make that happen?
He is not the savior.
He is not the savior. That if the people really want to get rid of, because who built the swamp? Who made the swamp as efficacious as it is today? Donald Trump.
Right.
Donald Trump was the guy that was throwing money into the elections of these people so that then he could control them and how they voted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wasn't the only one, but he was an architect to the swamp. He was doing what every other, you know, billionaire in the world was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, he was basically telling America that your government is up for sale. That he who pays these pipers will call the tune. And these pipers will give you, this is why I tell you that in the 1870 election, there was enough pressure and enough seats taken from the radical Republicans to serve the piper who called the tune for the Organic Act to be passed, to be written and passed, because that act should never have seen the light of day. It was
Organic Act.
It was absolutely repugnant to the Constitution. So you can't tell me that, you know, it all of a sudden
Congress, which did these two noble things, these awesome things, in protecting all men from oppression by the 14th Amendment, by ensuring that no government that wants to come in like Britain and fund an insurrection and or a coup over a matter like slavery, because that's what Britain was doing, folks. They were actually subsidizing the Civil War to break up and destroy the United States.
Yeah, right.
And so here we look at the 14th Amendment and what it did and said, you know, it slapped him in the face and said, you are entitled to nothing from us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when we really look at where we are today, the fact that it took 4 years for Britain to move enough of the pegs on the board, or enough change out enough of the pieces on the board so that they could get what they wanted, only proved that America could be sold. And we see it today. And to me, folks, this if there's any reason why we would need to pass the First Amendment, is to take away the billionaires' abilities to actually buy up all 6,700 or something like that. But right. Let's just say 7,000. I think it's somewhere around 67, 68. So it's closer to 7,000. So let's just say 7,000. Just imagine how hard it would be for them to actually go out, and because all of the redistricting and everything that else would have to occur, there's no way they could pay that. There's no way that this would completely displace the House of Representatives from the control of the globalists. Mm-hmm. The reason that we're keeping it to 435 makes it so much easier for them to all pitch in their millions of dollars to maintain control. Why not? They're making billions of – there are trillions of dollars made in the world each year. And I can prove that because if you look at just how the revenue that Walmart makes is almost $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. The revenue that Amazon makes is almost $1 trillion. And the revenue that ExxonMobil makes is almost $500 billion. So when we look at how much money is just floating around because they've created these empires to rule us, then folks, I can't see how we are being better served by letting them buy and control our government.
Right.
Remember when we read in the Massachusetts ratification debates how one of the anti-federalists talked about how, you know, foreign entities would buy up representations, or even, you know, ill people of another state would do that. You don't remember that, probably. That's okay.
I actually don't remember that.
That's okay. But they actually talked about how there could be a movement of using money to basically buy up representation, and how this was dangerous in allowing this Constitution to move forward because of that. And then the quip, or the response back to this gentleman, is that could be done under our current system as well.
Mm-hmm.
That can always be done. Money can always plague the politics of a nation unless we create the laws to keep money out of our elections. Now, Paul, you know as well as I do that there's actually a public relations tagline that would actually solve that problem. It's called making all elections local.
Right.
If we made all elections local, it would force the money involved in every election to only be able to come from the district of the election itself, or the area of the election, if it's the city council, if it's county, legislative district, whatever, no money can come from outside of that district, and you have to prove that it was germane to the district. In other words, that that money actually came from, you know, real profits, that it wasn't money funneled into somebody sitting there and then using that money because they live there. As you know, go ahead.
Right. I discovered something interesting yesterday. I got an email from someone about the 17th Amendment.
Uh-huh.
And what caused it, how the press was used to subvert it. And here's what they did. Okay? There was an article written in Cosmopolitan, a series of articles written in Cosmopolitan magazine about how money powers were buying senators.
Oh yeah.
They didn't solve the problem about the money. What they did was they did make the 17th Amendment. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the same problem that they had, that's how they sold the 17th Amendment, was that money was buying your representation. That hasn't changed in 110 years.
Well, actually, it empowered it better.
Right.
In other words, it shifted the money away from, you know, the power base of the representation, and allowed actually gave corporations with deeper pockets, you know, more freedom to get who they really wanted for less.
Right. And by the way, it actually named who these money powers are. It named Rockefeller. It named these big industrialists,
right,
as the bad guys.
Right.
Okay. Well, guess what? They're still there. All right. So uh-huh. What you're saying about making elections local,
right?
Okay, that's the problem that should have been solved.
Yes, that's the solution. Correct. That's the solution to getting true representation reestablished. You know, mm-hmm. the Madison, in his very first election, he lost. He lost his very first election, and it just infuriated him that he had to buy drinks to get elected. And this became such a problem that they actually passed laws, because Madison and many others became so vocal about it, they passed laws and made it impossible to sell drinks on election day.
Right.
In other words, being able to buy votes. Well,
right.
You know, when you give a politician some latitude to say, hey, if you vote for me, I can do this violation to the Constitution for you. No, mm-hmm. no. There,
right.
You cannot violate your oath of office. Obama violated his oath of office by championing an unconstitutional act.
Sure.
All of those people who voted for that all need to be tried for treason. All of them. When we really start peeling it back, these people have been committing insurrections in buying America into its fat, self-aggratiating self. Anyway, I'm going to have to we'll close this off tomorrow before we jump into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions again. But folks, I'm here to tell you that we have solutions, and these solutions are absolutely based on the founders and common sense and so forth. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.